Listen to KMOX anytime, anywhere. Download the radio.com app today.
I have a confession. I'm addicted to the news.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Journalism is cool again, and you have endless content, let's be honest.
And this is how I got elected, by being off script.
Now, Mark Reardon.
Well, I think he's got a lot of hand movement. I've never seen so much hand movement. I said, is he crazy, or is that just the way he acts?
On St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Well, let's get right into it here this afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, on Breonna Taylor. I spent quite a bit of time on this yesterday explaining a little bit about the facts of the case that people seem to not want to pay attention to. And I said at the time, and I've been really saying this for a couple of weeks now, that there was very little chance that these other officers were going to be charged. And I think I said yesterday, if there was going to be a reckless endangerment charge, that would probably be the more appropriate charge. And that's essentially what happened here. We're going to bring in Joe Arnold from Louisville this afternoon. My good friend, grew up here in the St. Louis area, formerly WHAS radio and television. And I know, you know, on a lighter note, this is not a light story, Joe, but I just tweeted out, because Louisville is at the center of probably the world right now, bracing for what might happen tonight. There are peaceful protests going on right now, but I just posted a video on Twitter of a couple of dudes just lighting up a joint right there live on TV. And I gave them credit, because at least they were making an attempt to be peaceful protesters. But what's the climate like before we get into all the specifics here? Louisville's on edge right now, right?
It's on edge, and I think it can go a variety of directions. Leading up to this, within the last couple of days, beginning on Monday, as officials were aware the grand jury was meeting, large concrete barriers, like the ones you would see basically like the concrete medians on the highway, were placed to block off downtown streets. Large filled dump trucks blocking off the large corridors of the central business district. And then, of course, a police presence as well. So that was preventing folks from necessarily congregating, at least by driving in. You can walk in if you park farther away. Right now, those marches that have begun, but they've kind of splintered off, and people are calling each other. And I think at this point, you never know what protesters, what the mind of, or what, this is what it boils down to. And one influential person can make a big difference in terms of what direction this goes, whether it goes south or whether it somehow is indeed what peaceful protesters want it to be, which is a demonstration of their frustration, their anger, and calls for racial justice. So right now you have marches going off away from downtown into the more of the, for lack of better words, gentrified areas of the east of downtown, and we'll see what happens. What's happened in the past, of course, is you've had some bad actors, especially as it gets darker at night and things can become a little bit more unsettled when things lose control. And there's a 72-hour curfew right now for the entire city, not just downtown, the entire city under a 72-hour curfew, 9 o'clock tonight. Everyone expected to be in their homes unless they have official business or need to go to the doctor or something like that.
Wow. So basically shut down for the next couple of days. I did not know that.
Yeah. So that's, you might call it, overkill in some respects, since we haven't seen specific threats of violence right now. But as you know, this has been burning for 190 plus days since this killing first happened with Breonna Taylor back in March. And, this has been percolating and certainly has been fed by the other, the George Floyd case and the situation in Kenosha and everything else. So, at this point, there are some professional protesters as well. I just saw a U-Haul truck on local coverage here pulled up to the perimeter of the blocked off area, and they're unloading shields and water and signs and things. So there is a mobilization, if you will, by some of these protesters. So there's been gearing up on all sides of this potential confrontation.
So let's kind of run down here what the Attorney General of Kentucky, Daniel Cameron, did today. Announced that he did very well, by the way. There's three officers, just to kind of round up the facts just a little bit. Jonathan Mattingly, Miles Cosgrove, Brett Hankinson. It was Hankinson who fired his weapon off. And I don't even know if they said today, they're not exactly sure. There were rumors, Joe, that maybe she or that the other officer was hit by friendly fire. Are they sure that it was Hankinson's gun that fired the bullet that hit, or the bullets that hit Breonna Taylor?
Just the opposite. It's what we talked about yesterday, Mark, and in your earlier conversations. None of the bullets from Brent Hankinson, the one who was charged, are thought to have hit Breonna Taylor. The officer who was charged right today with the wanton endangerment charge was the one who was outside the apartment, and he was fired as a result of his actions that night. The grand jury decided that he acted, you know, wantonly in endangering the people in the neighboring apartments when he was firing through windows and through walls and endangered their lives. The bullets that hit Breonna Taylor were fired by the two officers who were fired upon inside the apartment by Kenneth Walker, who was Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, there in the hallway with her when the officers entered the apartment.
Right. So, and I'm glad that you cleared that up, because what happened is, and we learned today, I think, some confirmation, there was a knocking at the door. They did knock. They entered the apartment. They were fired upon. And that's when Officer Hankinson opened fire, and the department felt, even before any kind of charges, that he should be fired. So he's been off the force for a while. But in this particular case, the Attorney General said, look, they were fired upon. The laws of Kentucky say that this was a justifiable use of force. He made it very clear, and I can make it very clear too. This is a terrible tragedy. She shouldn't have died, but there are so many things that people get wrong about this, Joe. As you know, everything from, you know, she was sleeping in bed, all these different things that have come up, that it was the wrong apartment. It was not the wrong apartment. They had actually documented pictures, photographs of their jailhouse recordings, all these things that led police, when they were surveilling the ex-boyfriend, who was also named Walker, no relation to the one that was in the apartment when the shooting took place, that in fact they were looking at him for drug dealing in her apartment. They felt was part of that plan and that scheme, and that's why she was being surveilled.
That's clear, and that's good fact-checking, Mark. But just to be clear about today's very carefully prescribed grand jury proceedings, intentionally had nothing to do with any of the evidence leading up to the officers serving the warrant. It only had to do with the officers' actions that they were charged with carrying out that warrant that night. Now, the Justice Department, the FBI, is doing a separate civil rights investigation into all the things you just mentioned. And whether that warrant was legitimate in the first place,
properly obtained, right?
Exactly. And the judges, but it was signed off by a judge. So to your point, this is a drug trafficking investigation that was months in operation. But that's frankly for another day. Now I can say that, but the folks in the street right now are not separating the two. They're saying, wait a second, this was not. She should not have been even the target. There should not have been a battering ram at her door anyway, is their contention. And that remains to be seen. But this particular grand jury decision today, and the charges against the one officer and the Attorney General's statements of the last hour, they are only having to do with the officers' actions who were there present. And just to be clear, you mentioned Kenneth Walker. He did shoot and he did hit and severely injured one of the officers, Jonathan Mattingly, who returned fire. So Mattingly returned fire. The other officer next to Mattingly when he was shot, Miles Cosgrove, according to the ballistics report from the FBI that was recently returned to Kentucky, the FBI determined that the shot from Miles Cosgrove is the one fatal shot of the six that hit Breonna Taylor that actually killed her.
Joe, I appreciate the help this afternoon. We might have you back tomorrow. I got Senator Hawley calling me here in just a couple of minutes. A very busy day. Joe Arnold down in Louisville for us on the Breonna Taylor case. And we'll talk soon, Mr. Arnold. I appreciate it.
Pray for Louisville. Thank you.
Yeah, no kidding. And here's one thing just factually that I want to get out there. And there are a lot of questions about the warrant, how it was obtained. I don't disagree with that. But there is a recording, a jailhouse call from January 3rd following Mr. Glover's arrest on trafficking and weapons charges. So this was earlier in the year. He calls Breonna Taylor from jail. This is the ex-boyfriend. Now, Benjamin Crump and others have said they were not in any kind of relationship for years, but this is a call from January 3rd, and he calls Breonna Taylor and says, contact one of my co-defendants to get jail money. This is paraphrased from the report, actually. Taylor says that that person is already at the trap. That's slang for a drug house, right? So Glover tells her, I need to be on standby. If I make bail, I'm going to get some rest in your bed, according to the recording. And then he says, love you. Love you too, she replied. In the email to the Courier-Journal, the lawyer who once claimed that the relationship was not ongoing apologized for mischaracterizing the relationship, saying it was based on an erroneous conclusion he drew without the benefits of the jail recording. So there's a lot of back and forth here that people need to probably get caught up on. And that's one of the problems with what's going to go on in Louisville. The people protesting, lighting fires, bashing windows at Target, they don't know any of the facts, and they don't care about the facts.
You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show.
When you're out of my sight, you must constantly Twitter me exactly what you're up to.
Follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Reardon, KMOX.
220, much more on Louisville and Breonna Taylor as we move through this afternoon. We're going to talk about youth sports coming back just a little bit in St. Louis County. Dan Buck's going to join me at the bottom of the hour and an update on what happened with the county council meeting last night, which didn't happen because there was a snafu. But let's get to Senator Josh Hawley on the Supreme Court nomination process right now. I think we just spoke, Josh, last week, and gosh, a lot's changed since then, hasn't it?
Oh boy, that's the truth. Big change. Obviously, the death of Justice Ginsburg has changed the world, Mark, and now the Senate's got a lot of work to do.
Well, let me start with RBG. You clerked for Justice Roberts. Did you know her at all, and your thoughts on her passing and her legacy?
Yeah, I did know her a little bit. I mean, as a clerk, you get to meet all of the justices, and she had lunch, hosted lunch for the four of us who were working for the Chief Justice that year, which included my wife, of course, and then two other clerks, and we interacted a lot with her staff and team. She was, you know, very smart, very tough, very capable. I can't say that I agreed with her on most anything, I certainly respect her and respect her work ethic. And her death will significantly change the United States Supreme Court. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Well, all right. So let's kind of talk about what's going to happen now. And I heard your explanation. I played a little of the audio yesterday, and I understand the explanation. But this is one of the questions that people have: why isn't it hypocritical for Republicans to push this nominee before the election, considering what happened with Merrick Garland in 2016?
You know, Mark, for that one, that predates me, of course, in the Senate. I wasn't here then, and my perspective is this: I'd think that it would be. This is an opportunity. It's an obligation, actually, for Republicans to keep their promises and do what they've been telling their voters they will do. And that's certainly true for me. I mean, you remember my 2018 race featured the Supreme Court front and center, Justice Kavanaugh. And I said then that I would go to the Senate, and I would go to the floor, and I would fight for pro-Constitution, pro-life justices. And that is, by golly, exactly what I intend to do. So I see this as Republicans have some promises to keep, and they'd better keep them. I mean, that's my perspective on it.
Do you think, let's talk about the timetable here with hearings and everything. Well, let me start with this. Do you have a favorite choice right now? Outside of yourself, because you were on the list, but he already said it was going to be a woman. So,
no,
you know, we'll take you off.
I'm my least favorite choice and not on the list. I told the president, take me off that list.
Yes, yes.
My view on this is, Mark, that the number one thing I think in terms of getting through the gate with me is I want to see a nominee who understands that Roe versus Wade was an exercise in judicial imperialism, that it is a deeply flawed and, in fact, wrongly decided case, and I want to see a nominee where there's evidence that she, I believe it will be a she, that she understands that and acknowledges that. And that, to me, is absolutely vital, because if you can't recognize that about Roe, that tells me you don't really understand the role of the court, that it's the court's job to interpret the Constitution, not to impose your own views, whatever those may be. So that's a threshold matter for me. I really think that the president, I've got every confidence the president is going to nominate someone who meets that criteria. And I'll have a lot more questions, of course, about the Second Amendment, about religious liberty. But I feel pretty good. I think the president is going to put somebody up who will be very proud of.
But you said in an interview over the summer, and you were quoted in the Washington Post saying that, you know, you basically want a nominee who has explicitly acknowledged that Roe v. Wade is wrongly decided. By explicitly, you mean on the record before they were nominated. Is that something that's happened with any of the favorites like Amy Coney Barrett right now that you're aware of, or does that disqualify her?
No, it's certainly true of Amy Barrett. I think Amy Barrett's record on this is quite lengthy. She has written about Roe. She has spoken about Roe. She's been careful not to say how she will vote in a case, which she can't do because the ethics rules prevent her from doing that. But it's very clear from her on-the-record statements that she understands the problems with Roe. She understands the deep flaws in Roe. She has commented on those and, in fact, has taught about those when she was a professor at some length. I've reviewed even her lecture notes, Mark. I've read a lot of what Judge Barrett has written recently and what she said in public, and I think she clearly meets the test that I put forth. And whomever the president nominates, I think we're going to find out here very shortly. I hope will satisfy those criteria.
So let's talk about the timetable. The announcement's going to come this weekend. Then you have hearings, or do you have a lot of hearings? Can this be done and voted on before Election Day? What are your thoughts there?
It can absolutely be done and voted on before Election Day, and it should be. And we will have hearings. I think we should have the full slate of hearings in public. But what you can cut out is a lot of the dead space when the justice or judicial nominee would go and meet with senators. That often takes a month, 2 months. These are sort of one-on-one meetings. Not much comes from these. That all can be condensed. I mean, look, Justice Ginsburg was nominated and confirmed in about 40 days. Justice Stevens was nominated and confirmed in 19 days. These are both modern justices in the modern era. It's not like it was, you know, back in the 1800s. So there's a lot of precedent for doing this in the time that we have available. The Senate will need to work with purpose. I mean, we won't be able to dilly-dally, but I am totally in favor of doing this before Election Day, and I believe we can.
How concerned are you about what happens maybe in the future with Democrats and this talk about court packing, although they seemingly have backed off that a little bit, but that's been out there?
Oh, I think they absolutely want to do it. They wanted to do it before there was this vacancy, and they're going to want to do it afterwards. I don't think there's any doubt about that, and I take it deadly serious. And I think that every voter should, too. I mean, I just urge Missourians to pay attention to what the Democrats are saying. They're telling us what they want to do. They want to get into power. They want to pack the Supreme Court. They want to fundamentally change the United States Senate. They're talking now about impeaching the president as a way to try to slow down this process. They are willing to violate every norm. And in fact, if they were to file impeachment articles, that would be a straight up violation of the Constitution itself. They are willing to do that in order to try to get their way. And here's the thing, Mark. The reason that they're in the bind they're in is because they didn't win elections. They lost in 2016. They lost in 2018 when voters sent a bigger Republican Senate majority to Washington. So if Democrats want to enact their agenda, they've got to convince voters. But between now and then, to threaten to burn down the Constitution because they're not getting their way when voters haven't given them the majority, that's crazy, and frankly, it's undemocratic.
One final question. I noticed a tweet, and I don't know much about this at this point, about Nicole Galloway and an investigation that you revealed this morning. Can you tell us any more about that?
Well, it's big news. I mean, the State Accountancy Board, who oversees all auditors in the state of Missouri, wrote to me a few days ago. I just recently got the letter and said that they've opened an investigation of Nicole Galloway based on the evidence that she altered audits for political purposes. She certainly tried to do that in my case, so they still couldn't find any wrongdoing, any ethics violation, nothing against me with all of these allegations Democrats made time and time again. But and that's despite there being hard evidence on the record that Galloway altered a report. I mean, you've got her auditors emailing one another saying, you know, maybe we ought to beef up this section because there really isn't anything here on the allegations against Hawley. So maybe we'll beef up this other section, you know, make it look like there's something there. I mean, it's unbelievable. So all of the accountancy board has all of that, and they've said they're going to open an investigation, and they absolutely should. I mean, that kind of political abuse of office should not be allowed and should not be rewarded. She's also got political consultants on her payroll. I mean, it's really unbelievable, Mark. And again, this is something I'm sure voters will want to hear about.
All right, we're going to look into it. Senator Josh Hawley, I know you're busy with votes and everything else on the Hill. I appreciate you squeezing us in this afternoon. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for having me.
229, a lot of stuff to pack in here this afternoon. When we come back, Dan Buck's going to join us. I guess you could say Sam Page blinked a little bit on the youth sports restrictions. We'll talk about that coming up here in just a couple of minutes.
Weekday mornings at 8:30, Charlie Brennan and Amy Markscores provide perspective on KMOX and KMOX.com.
Just ask my producer, Dave Klein, during the break, who's pitching tonight in the Cardinals game? I had not known that. He said Carlos Martinez. Who, Dave, what is his ERA hovering at right now?
He is 0-2 with an ERA of 8.4, Mark.
Ah, there's time. There's time for Carlos. You know, I love Carlos. Remember when he came in a few years ago and he splashed water in his face? When they
were doing
that
was a fun time.
That routine, it was fun. And I do have a soft spot for him, but I hope for improvement tonight. By the way, how cool were those uniforms last night?
Really, I loved them. Loved them. Absolutely loved them. And like you and I were talking about, very confusing that the Royals were in red and the Cardinals were in blue. Really strange.
Yeah, five-year-old Alexa Reardon was very confused by that. She did not understand it, but we tried to clear it up. On the topic of sports this afternoon, for parents who have been looking for some relief, perhaps a glimmer of hope, Dan Buck is back with us, the head of PowerPlex, and Sam Page made some decisions, I guess, on loosening some of the restrictions. Dan's on the Quiver River Electric guest line. How are you, Mr. Buck, this afternoon? Good afternoon.
I am good, Mike Reardon. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm good. You know, Chief Fitch is going to come on here after 3 o'clock. That meeting that was going to take place last night, I guess they had technical difficulties, and there's more than 400 comments for that particular bill, and this thing has just grown and grown. And Dan, I appreciate, you know, your passion and work on this, because you guys have been raising some great questions here with the county, with Sam Page. So what happened today, and are you satisfied for now?
Well, you know, of course we're happy that what should have happened 5 months ago finally happened today. There's never been any high numbers of any sort in that 14 and under age bracket. So it's finally been acknowledged, and all sports under 14 can now play games, and high school has also opened up for the intermediate sports. But, you know, I'm sorry, if you're a 15, 16, or 17-year-old high-contact sport, and that's football and basketball and ice hockey and lacrosse, and, you know, even though there's zero evidence that these sports spread at any higher rate than a cross-country meet that's got 100 kids packed at a starting line and running elbow to elbow through a race, no sport at any level is showing transmission due to competitive activity. And I think that's been the frustration of parents, is that give us numbers, give us facts, give us data, give us case studies, give us contact tracing, give us something that warrants that St. Louis County should be shut down. I mean, what does St. Louis County know that 111 other counties in the state of Missouri don't know? I mean, I think that's been the million-dollar question, even though we're in week six of football games all over the state with no – you know, large transmission rates, no athlete-to-athlete transmission, and certainly no serious illness or deaths to report. So I think we're just all kind of, you know, a little dumbfounded of how we can separate out some of this stuff. For example, he keeps using this 15 to 19-year-old range. Well, you know this, that the 18 and 19-year-olds are not in college. I mean, they're not in high school. They're in college. So why are we putting those numbers while trying to make decisions for the high school rank?
Yeah, that makes no sense. That doesn't make any sense at all. Now, I guess they say that the health department says that there were 5 clusters. They refer to these as clusters of virus transmission among young athletes that were linked to sports practices or games, and those involved a couple of high school athletes, I guess. Is that what they're basing all this on?
Well, take that number alone by itself, right? Right now in St. Louis County, there are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,300 to 1,500 different teams and different sports and activities that are practicing. And you have 5 cases of an athlete-to-athlete transmission? I mean, that doesn't even hit on the risk spectrum. And again, very speculative. But even if they had actual contact-to-contact tracing, wouldn't a health department want to tell us what sport, what venue, what team, what arena? Because we can't find those 5 cases. No one's coming forward saying they have, you know, athlete to athlete. They did shut down and quarantine over 600 athletes because of cases within teams. But most of those are single isolated cases, which is a clear indicator that it didn't happen on that team because there's not multiple cases on the team. But I just think that the shutdown narrative isn't supported by what we're asking for. Therefore, we can't get the numbers. And that is, why can't we get specific age numbers? It is I've been around research long enough to know. I've done my own research and data queries for years when I worked at St. Patrick's Center. All it is putting in the date range. If they can give you a range 15 to 19, they can give you the specific how many of those are 15, how many of those are 16, how many of those are 17, 18, and 19.
Right.
Because they don't give it to you because they know that 18 and 19 is dominating that age class. And if I was a college
parent,
I'd be upset to not
Dan,
know
you're
what
just
those
stonewalled then on that question. You just can't get those answers, right?
And the press won't ask them either. And obviously, you can't get what you don't ask. It's a simple data query. This is not hard science to try to give us. Because if you factor out the 18 and 19-year-olds, the transmission rates will plummet. I promise you that. Just from our own data, from the 2,400 teams we've surveyed and the 26,000 athletes, all of our counts are in the much older brackets because their social behaviors
are
much different.
Yeah, I even heard testimony today on Capitol Hill from Dr. Fauci and others that would back a lot of that up. But it sounds to me, I mean, I just have to guess here that the reason that they're still going to go with is this notion that it's the parents who are getting together, or it's whatever happens before and after the sporting events that's leading to a spread of infection, or their gut check on that. That's what they used last time, right?
Yes, but another example of false and unrelated data is that they also never give age breakouts on hospitalizations. Who is getting sick? Who is needing significant care? Again, you never, ever see age demographics on their hospitalizations. Does anybody else wonder why? Because week after week, month after month, those numbers are 90 to 95% over the age of 50. Why doesn't he tell that information? Why? Because it doesn't support that narrative that youth sports kids and parents are at risk of serious illness. And they're not. I am telling you, young, healthy adult parents are not the folks who are being critically, assaulted by this virus. Why are we having press conferences and putting kids at the focus of this? This is like trying to build a $40 million dam to stop the water in a mud puddle. I mean, it just drives me crazy that we continually are focusing on kids when they are not at risk. They have proven that this virus is, and even their transmission, the Fauci and others have come out and said that asymptomatic children are not giving this to adults, and they have factual data to support that. But even if, let's say, the parents have it, are they at risk of serious illness and hospitalization? Well, according to their own numbers, that's not the case. If you got those age demographics of the hospitalizations, you would clearly see that this is a virus that is attacking the minorities, that is attacking senior citizens, that is attacking people with comorbidities. There's a lot of people that need to be protected, and our focus and our shutdowns and our guidelines should be focused on those people, not on the healthy parents of young teenagers and kids who are just trying to play a game and get on with their lives, knowing this virus is not a major serious threat to their lives. And now if you've got illnesses, if you've got asthma, if you've got other types of major health concerns, you need to protect yourself and you need to make sure that you aren't in large gatherings. But that is not the case in most youth sports environments and with most parents.
Dan, where do you go from here then, outside of supporting what, the county council, what Mark Carter and Chief Fitch are trying to do? What's the next step here?
Well, kind of, Mark, I'd say it's a challenge to you and other members of the media to ask or demand those two major factual data points. Let's get the age breakouts of the positive cases by actual age, not the ranges. We want the actual age. And two, every single time that Sam gives the new hospitalization daily, demand, number one, that they give the discharge numbers, because discharges have been consistently outpacing admissions for weeks. Did you know that? No, most people don't know that, because you got to dig way, way down low to find the discharge numbers. But also demand the age demographics of those hospital admissions, because, again, you're going to quickly see that the high-risk COVID-19 affected population is just not in the youth sports athletes or their parents' age range. They're all under the age of 50 for the most part. Just do the math, right? So you don't have to be a virologist or a medical researcher to know that these numbers are very easy to extract. I think it's incumbent on this health department to start being honest with all the numbers and giving the full story, not the partial stories or the ranges that help support their narrative. Let's get the full data. which is all we've been asking for. And I wish the media would hammer home about this. Quit taking the data they keep giving us and start asking for the data they're not giving you that are pretty easy assumptions and questions to ask. That, you know, you can look at those numbers and say, well, why are you just giving us the hospital admissions when you're not giving us the discharges? Why aren't you giving us the age breakouts by age on both the hospitalization as well as on the positivity rate? I mean, these are all very simple, matter-of-fact ideas or questions that continually need to be asked because we're not getting the full story, and it's an injustice, it's a shame, and unfortunately, it's keeping a lot of kids out of doing sports that they love.
Keep up the fight, Dan Buck. I appreciate the update this afternoon, and we'll see what happens into the future. Hopefully this is, at the very least, a good sign that, you know, we're going to have some progress moving forward. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.
Mark, appreciate you, man, keeping the light on it. That's great. Appreciate it, buddy.
And my county councilman, Tim Fitch, former St. Louis County Police Chief, is going to come up a little bit after 3, just update you on what happened last night. That meeting, I got to figure out what happened, too. It was a technological glitch, and they have been just swamped with emails that I guess have to be read tonight. We're going to find out a little after 3 on KMOX. It's 2:46.
Listening to KMOX has never been easier.
Siri, play KMOX.
2:51 at KMOX. We'll have some time in the next hour to tackle a bunch of different issues. It's been a busy day, and you sort of knew yesterday or maybe even the day before that the decision on the Breonna Taylor case was going to probably happen today. Then we knew yesterday that it would come down, and we covered that extensively at the beginning of the show. If you have radio.com, if you use that, you can rewind and listen to Joe Arnold, who used to be at WHAS Radio and Television, help me out with the reporting on that this afternoon. And I do have... I have some more audio that I want to get to on that as we get through the afternoon. We might be able to do that just a little bit at 3:07. I mentioned Councilman Fitch is going to join me, talk about the council meeting that did not happen last night and that apparently will happen today. And then, look, I thought it was when we got 120, 150 emails a few weeks ago, I thought that was a lot, but they've had more than 400 that I think they have to read tonight. I don't know. We'll find out the details about that. Also, a lot of you have started voting already, and the absentee process is underway. We had St. Louis County Republican Election Commissioner Rick Stream on about a month ago, and I want a little bit of a refresher course this afternoon because I think a lot of people want to get the jump on that. We'll also have, I think we're going to get some numbers from Dr. Garza this afternoon, and my buddy Vance Crowe, who is the owner of Articulate Ventures, which is a marketing firm. Vance is a really interesting guy, and for some reason he got very desperate and invited me to be on his podcast, and we're going to talk about that. Actually, kind of a funny story because it is a video podcast. I was unaware that it was also going to be a video podcast, and I made some questionable decisions when it comes to attire, I think, on that podcast. But we'll get to that a little bit later. Hey, I do want to play, you know, one of the things I mentioned on Monday as we started the week when it came to RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I think her story is really amazing, and I think she deserves all the accolades and the respect that she's getting this week. And let's not forget, and this is what kind of wins me over, is that she was extremely close with Justice Scalia. They loved each other. They deeply loved each other as friends. And I love that. It proves that you can disagree with someone and still have a friendship. Although I think that that's been lost. And, you know, you almost wonder if that type of relationship can sustain itself right now. But Justice Roberts, as they welcomed RBG's casket into the Capitol today, as she will lie in repose, here's what John Roberts had to say.
Her mother was born 4 months after her family arrived from Poland. Her mother later worked as a bookkeeper in Brooklyn. Ruth used to ask, "What is the difference between a bookkeeper in Brooklyn and a Supreme Court justice?" Her answer, "One generation." It has been said that Ruth wanted to be an opera virtuoso, but became a rock star instead. But she chose the law.
I like that line about a rock star. All right, so he described Ruth Bader Ginsburg a little bit during these moments this morning.
Among the words that best describe Ruth, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful, careful, compassionate, honest. When it came to opera, insightful, passionate. When it came to sports, clueless.
I had heard that in the past. That's, you know, I'm clueless on opera, so I'll just say that. You know, I like all kinds of music. I did really like the movie Amadeus, and bought that soundtrack 40 years ago, and I guess there's a little bit of Mozart when it comes to opera that I would like, but that's about it. Never been to the opera, really don't desire to go to the opera. And I mentioned Justice Scalia. He told this story.
Many of you have seen the famous picture of Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg riding atop an elephant in India. It captured so much of Ruth. There she was, doing something totally unexpected, just as she had in law school, where she was not only one of the few women, but a new mother to boot. And in the photograph, she is riding with a dear friend, a friend with totally divergent views. There is no indication in the photo that either was poised to push the other off.
Yeah, and I think that that's a story that it's important. And I'm so frustrated right now, and I've told this story. You know, I mentioned that podcast that I did with Vance, and he'll join me at 3:35. But I truly feel, and maybe I'm wrong about some of this stuff, because I haven't engaged completely with friends. I have some friends around the country that have been, you know, pretty quiet, and I've alienated myself, I suppose, because of some of the things that I've said in the aftermath of George Floyd, or I've posted on my show Facebook page. See, I try not to do that on Facebook. I have my personal page, but I usually do pictures of my daughter and my animals and things like that. But on the show page, we do politics. You're going to find some opinions on that. And clearly people who have pressed like on the show page that are friends of mine have seen those things. But it's frustrating because I don't know why we can't have those friendships or healthy disagreements without losing respect and still caring about one another. But that's apparently not possible in 2020 or maybe even beyond. It's 2:56. We'll take a break. Just a quick update from Councilman Fitch on that meeting that did not take place last night that will take place tonight. And also a bunch more and an audio cut of the day before 4 o'clock on KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.